My first favorite historian has to be Helen Hunt Jackson. And if you ever get to read, she wrote a book. She was a woman. And she wrote a book called A Century of Dishonor. And in that book, she attacks how the Americans have treated the Indians up until over a century ago. But what makes her my hero isn't only that she decided that the Indians were ill-treated, which was not a popular thing to write, by the way, but her book is a classic. You can still get it in the library. But she goes into a conversation in the book that America should dig that book up and read it again. She says the Indian nations are really nations. They're nations in every definition of the word nations. And she says, and we should treat them that way. It's a wonderful book. Someone should drag them up, and especially Native American studies, and have our people have another look at her. Then there's another one. My favorite 20th century historian. You know what? To be a historian, a real historian, takes courage. It takes lots of courage. And my vote for the most courageous person is Angie Debo. And Angie Debo died at, I don't know what she was, 199 something. By that time, she was the state historian for Oklahoma. But Angie Debo was this little modest historian, got her PhD in history. And then she went into the archives, and she found out that the people of Oklahoma had been systematically robbing the Indians, robbing them. So she wrote a book that named names, that showed documents, that gave dates of people who had systematically, criminally abused the Indians. And those systematical criminal people were still alive, and they were running the state of Oklahoma. And she took her book to the University of Oklahoma Press, and of course they ran her out of town. It took her years to get some of her books published, among the most interesting of which is called And Still the Waters Run. It's a wonderful book. There's a movie about her, though. And every once in a while, it shows on television. So if you ever see the movie about Angie Debo, give it a watch. Anyway, Angie Debo has a quote. And of all of the historical quotes, hers is my favorite. Talking about the fathers who founded Oklahoma, she said, "Those gentlemen were crookeder than two buckets of snakes." I don't know how you could say it any better. What they did do, though, is in Oklahoma, when the five civilized tribes arrived there, they discovered that some of those tribes had accidentally parked on top of lands that contained oil. It was one of the most outrageous periods of dispossession ever done. Sometimes it was done in the form of murder. Sometimes it was done in the form of children being adopted and their lands and properties disappropriated by other people. But it was an extraordinary period. And it's not so long ago, but it was an extraordinary period of dispossession. And Angie Debo had the courage to write about it while it was still going on. You had to give her credit for that. If we were to have had such a person living here 100 years ago, that person would have had to write about dispossession of people, land deals that weren't right, and all kinds of hard things to write about, because that's what was happening. But even to this day, most people don't know that there was a problem. They don't know that there were lands that were taken fraudulently. They don't know how things happened, how things were transferred from one person's hands to the next person's hands. Some years ago, in the United States, there was an odd thing that happened. And I'm going to tell this story because I already know some people are going to say, but, we've made it up with the casino, so hear my story. A group of Indians decided that they were going to try to come up with a plan where they could make some money doing bingo halls. So they found bingo, and then they gave the bingo high stakes. And the high stakes bingo attracted big crowds, and they were making lots of money. And then the state came and said, you can't do that, it's illegal. Went to court, and the court decided that you could do that, that the Indians had enough sovereignty left to enable them to be able to regulate their own bingo. Since bingo was legal in the state, it would be legal in the Indian country, but the state couldn't regulate it, Indians could. So high-stakes Indian bingo was legal. This gave people some thoughts. Now, if you can remember back to the glory days of the gambling casino. For the first thing was is that the gambling casinos, you know, were mostly shut down around the turn of the century because of a huge raft of scandals having to do with cheating people and doing all kinds of nasty things. So in most places, gambling was made illegal by the states. So that by about 1945, there were hardly any states that had legalized it. And then you all know, of course, that Nevada was an exception. And you will remember who it was that went to Nevada to start the gambling casinos there, right? You remember? So, okay, so the American mafia went to the criminal element, went to there. Famous guys, too, built up Las Vegas. Years later, the corporations came. And they said, essentially, well, you know, you guys are making a lot of money. And they started putting pressure on them. And they said, we'll take it from here. So the big corporations like Bally's and Holiday Inn and blah, 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 big casino and hotel change became the mafia. They took over and got that. And then when this thing about Indian bingo halls came up, they looked at the Indian bingo hall and they said, gee, why not casinos? And here was the plan. If the Indians could have casinos, the states, they could be imposed on the states. Once you impose an Indian casino on a state, the states weren't going to let the Indians have a monopoly on casinos. So the states would change their laws, and then everybody could have a casino. So the Indians would build their casino, and then the big corporate casino would come and build a bigger, better casino across the street, and they'd run the Indian casino out of business, and they'd have casinos all over the place. So that's how you would bring casinos to the states that didn't want casinos. But the plan didn't always work very well, to say the least. One of the first ones that went up, they went to the Indians. The Indians said, okay, we'll do that. Well, first they had to. I'm not even going to get to that. Okay. So then they started one of them, and the Indians turned to the Malaysians, and they said, we need a lot of money to build a big casino. And they built a big casino, and the big casino got bigger and bigger and bigger until the big casino was too big to build a big casino across the street from. And so that plan didn't work out. And so casinos went up here, there, the other place, blah, blah, blah. Some places, Indians have been lucky and they've had good luck with their casinos. Some places, they didn't have so much good luck. But of all the places that are interesting, New York was particularly interesting because New York had casinos, had no casinos, but they had a piece of their constitution that said, can't have that. And now we got a question and a whole bunch of things going to happen, this or that. But in New York, the casino got tangled up with another problem. And the other problem was land claims. So in New York, the way they wanted to handle the casino was to combine them with land claims. So you had casinos and land claims together. And then that really hasn't worked out very well either. But in the end, I think one of the things that happens in American perception, when you talk to people about Indians, they think every Indian in the country is wealthy because all the Indians have casinos and so on and so forth, when in fact that's not the case at all. Only a few of them have casinos, and some of the Indians actually refused casinos. But in fact, a much more significant number of Indians refused to have casinos. And I want to say this about some of these Indians. Not all Indians do the same thing. Indians aren't monolithic. But some of the Indians refused casinos, believe it or not, because they thought that casinos were wrong. Can you imagine that? They just didn't think it was a good idea. They didn't think governments should be having casinos. Other people disagreed, and they went ahead and they built casinos. So you had a great division and disagreement in the Indian country about casinos. I would like to propose to you that that was a legitimate disagreement, that people thought through what they thought were their options and what they thought was good for them, and some came to one conclusion and some came to a different conclusion. It seems to me, though, that on the whole, that gambling casinos and land claims shouldn't have been connected. They shouldn't have been confused. Okay, I want to go back just for a minute to the beginning of my story here. The Americans, it was true, devised a system of democracy. Sometimes actually overextending themselves, thinking about what their democracy is. But let me say this about how the Indians and the American democratic system need to be thought about, and then how the whole democratic system needs to be thought about in the world. A democratic system does not enjoy justice. It does not ensure justice. A democratic system has some good things about it, and I'm sure everybody will say, well, we can't think of anything better. Okay. But it doesn't ensure justice. If there's an injustice that needs to be fixed, can you guarantee that you can fix it by taking it to a vote, to hold up a referendum on it? Is that how you fix it? When you think about the injustices that have taken place in American culture, and we've acknowledged some of those, by the way, and tried to fix them. It isn't that America's always bad and never does anything right, but when you think about them, you can think about injustices that were done and that no system of democracy rises to fix it. And I think you could see how that worked for 100 years after the Civil War. No democratic process arose that was going to fix the problems of injustice that arose in the South and in the North, and having to do with racial discrimination and all that stuff. In fact, American democracy has never risen, as far as I know, to address issues of injustice. That's not to condemn it as a terrible system. It's just a reality that, as a whole, it doesn't address injustice. It doesn't want to hear about injustice. It doesn't want to believe that it has anything to do with injustice. It's in huge denial all the time of everything having to do with injustice. And it punishes people who come and complain that there's an unjust thing that's happened, for the most part. Not always, but often. Switch for a moment to 2005 or 6 and the world, the whole world. Wherever you go in the world, right now, America's at its lowest period, its lowest moment of popularity on the planet. Right after World War II, people around the world cheered America. They saw America as saviors, as liberators. They really did throw flowers at their feet. They welcomed our soldiers in Europe. America was a hero, having gotten rid of the Nazis. And I think so too, in 1946. But you don't remain a hero because you did one thing once. You can lose that. And when we go around the world today, there's a huge amount of people who feel that we haven't done the right thing by them. And the biggest place they think that is in the Muslim world. And what's the Muslim world's complaint about us? They say that we're not just. Well, most of our people are in denial. We say, well, of course we are. And I think that most people mean to be just, but I don't think that they've listened or understand what those people mean when they say we haven't been just. Democracies don't do justice that well. Given the chance to vote, they would vote that there was no justice at all, most of the time. And it's a complex issue, and it's one that we need to address. Actually, I know this almost because I'm in a way you're probably thinking I'm scolding a little bit, but actually I kind of think that the America I grew up in is capable of addressing that issue. I don't believe it's not capable. I just think it hasn't addressed it. That's all. And I think it needs to address it a little bit. Okay, back to the other one. Angie Debo, when she wrote her thing about what happened in Oklahoma, she wrote about a terrible injustice. And trust me, Americans that read her books get the point. And people are thinking and working on understanding how that could have happened. And of course, today they don't want it to happen again. Nobody wants to see that kind of stuff go on. And I think that that's going to be kind of the issues that we have. In New York State, I could go through the thing, but it'll be in the papers and documents and things that you can see. There were significant injustices. They haven't been addressed. They need to be addressed. A democracy can be big enough to address them. There's no threat to anybody. There's no problem really addressing it. They need to be addressed. Years ago, I remember talking to Chief Irv Paulus Sr., the father of the individual who was here last week, and one of my earliest conversations with him, I asked him a question. I said, we were talking about land claims, and I said, what is it that you want? He says, we want to have people acknowledge that there's a problem. And he said, in a way, that really is what they wanted. It's not a trick answer. I at first listened very carefully to them, and I'm convinced it's a real answer. They want acknowledgement that something wrong happened. And I think that that can be done. I've often thought about this. If people had addressed this stuff from the beginning, we wouldn't have had a problem at all. It was just the effort was to not address it. Back in the 1790s, the United States caught itself in a dilemma of its own making, right at the earliest moments of its days as an independent nation. The United States assumed in 1784 that because the British had surrendered at Yorktown, that all the lands that were in the Allies' hands of the British, all those lands had reverted to the United States by conquest. And so they went and told the Indians, we own all of this. And especially they began to claim the lands on the other side of the Ohio River. So a war ensued, and a terrible war it was. The biggest defeat of the United States armed forces at the hands of the Indians took place during this war. It took place in a battle that took place in Ohio. I'd almost bet anything, hardly anyone in this room can tell me about it, what that battle was or what it was about. But anyway, okay, 1791. The battle takes place, and then 900 American soldiers are killed. And then the United States has to do something. So they appoint General Washington, or President Washington appoints, Met Anthony Wayne, and he founds the army. And the army marches eventually for a couple of years. It gets into Ohio. But in those period between that, they sent people to the West to meet with the Western Confederacy, the Indians in Ohio. And they asked Seneca Indians to lead the charge to that. And some of the Senecas went and asked the Western Indians to consider the offer that the United States was making. The United States decided that they were going to try a trick that they had never tried before. They were going to try treating the Indians fairly. It had never been done, so they thought they'd give it a shot, and they did. They went to the Indians, and they offered them a fair market value for their land, offered to buy it from them, pay for it, and the Indians just didn't respond to it. Eventually, the Indians refused the payment. That led to a war, and the war led to the first American victory of the U.S. Army in a place called Fallen Timbers. And that led to, that was just before, by the way, the meeting that the United States was going to have in Canandaigua in the fall of 1794. So in the mixture of stuff that happened, the United States then met with the Indians and had a treaty. And I have to say that the intent of the United States at the Treaty of 1794 was to treat the Indians honorably, to act honorably on their own side, to set up rules and things that were going to be equitable to all sides, to create a condition of a win-win between the Indians and the United States. So they signed this treaty of peace and friendship, the Canandaigua Treaty, and it's one that you'll hear about again and again. Since then, you will notice that wherever there's been equitable treatment of people, conflicts and issues get resolved, they're put away forever, and people move on. It's when we can't address them, they don't ever get resolved, they don't ever get put away, and we never get to move on. Most of the time, it probably would have been just simpler to do the right thing in the first place. I know that's not popular all the time, but I propose to you that in many of the cases that we're looking at about these so-called land claims and everything, had it been done right the first time, we'd have gotten it done, that would be the end of it. And we can come back now and still do it right this time. So that's kind of where we're at. Going back to the first part, I think it's a possibility that we, all the peoples who live in North America, will never be done trying to understand the principles of democracy and freedom. It's not one of those things that you get done and it's done and you walk away from it. You know what I mean? It's one of those things that it's an ongoing project. You have to renew it over and over again. Your thinking has to keep up with the times. Every time that you acquire a way of doing something democratic, somebody acquires a way of figuring out how to undo it. It's just a reality. It's a way of life. It's not something that's a done deal. You can't take credit for it and leave it on your ancestors and say, okay, I got that done. We're all over. We're all done with it. Every generation's got to renew it themselves. Every generation's got to do it all over again. Every generation has to free itself from something. And we do too. Our generation too. Fortunately, actually, there's the will to do that. But we need to rethink sometimes, I think, how precious it is. How precious it is to have those traditions imbued in us. We can't actually take a tradition, do you know this, and put it on a piece of paper. It doesn't work that way. A tradition is something that's either lived or it doesn't exist. So when you say you have an American democratic tradition, you have to live it. You can't get somebody to enact it. That much, I think, the Indians of all time always knew about. So that's where we're at, I think, in our time. It's an issue that isn't just your issue. It's everybody's issue. And I hope that we can all kind of like live through it and see to it that everybody gets what it is they need at the end. So those are my thoughts for this evening. I imagine that there's a tradition here of people having a chance to ask questions. Is that right? Do you do that? Okay. So I'm willing to field some questions.
Seneca Elder and SUNY Professor John Mohawk. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. We return to the conclusion of the talk by Professor John Mohawk.
A question, I guess, of history, which is something I'm trying to understand. If there were people like Benjamin Franklin and others who were sort of knowledgeable and interested and cared about the Indians, and then at the later on the Sullivan-Clinton campaign came through, was there any folks of that group, of that caliber, who actually objected, who protested, who said anything about what was happening?
You mean in the form of the Clinton-Sullivan campaign?
Yeah.
The short, quick answer to that is there were people who were not enthusiastic about it, but they didn't have much of a voice in it. I also want to say a little bit about, I will always remember having a conversation with my mother. My mother lived through the worst days of World War II, and the issue was coming up some years ago about whether the United States should have bombed Japan. And my mother was adamant that the United States should have bombed Japan. She said it saved a lot of lives. And you see, she lived that moment. She lived in that time. I have information that says they shouldn't have bombed Japan. I can show that they didn't need to bomb Japan, that the Japanese wanted to give up and blah, blah, blah. But I didn't live in that moment. She did. I can't judge her very well, because I didn't live the time she lived. And I'm willing to say that, too, about what happened in history sometimes. Things happen in history, and sometimes it's hard. You know, look at them and say, gee, I wish they didn't do that. And I think that that's a case for scorched earth campaigns like that one. But then I'm not willing to feel that we need to revisit them either. I know that the Americans were desperate. I mean, today we read this stuff and it's so painless to read it almost and look at what happened in the American Revolution. But you know, the American Revolution was a nasty fight. People were driven to extremes that the people living on the west of Albany were not able to maintain their farms. That there was food shortages. There were diseases that were getting after people. The raids were terrifying everybody on some areas of the frontier. So I don't think the Sullivan campaign was something that we should model our future at, but I'm willing to agree that we weren't there, and I don't know how I'd have felt about it if I was on one side or the other at the time. It's a hard question. I would always like to say that the people who went before us had experiences that no matter how hard we study the history, we can never really understand their experience, their passions, and what drives them. But we can undo things that got done as a result of that sometimes, and that need to be undone, if they need to be undone. And if there's such a thing, then somebody should make an argument for that, and we'll go with that.
I'm very impressed with what you said tonight about the need for the ideals of the American Revolution to go forward, that it's not a static, done deal, but rather something that we each have a responsibility in our lifetimes to carry this forward. And I've lived here all my life, and I've seen so much of what I've learned of the history of the Haudenosaunee confirmed in what I suspected happened historically. Like, I could see how the Onondaga's sympathies with the British and against the crazy colonialists in the Revolution sort of stamped the whole how the central New York region developed, you know, how they built the roads over the trails and like how they initially came into Onondaga Hill to separate out the Indian village and things like that. I think the Onondagas have provided an amazing model for us. Instead of like the paranoia of the land claims that we see in other areas of the state, here the land is not an issue, but rather stewardship and responsibility for the land. I just am eager people like myself who was born in Syracuse, and therefore it appears that we were born on actually what was legally sovereign Onondaga land, like what we can do to become like partners in this, because it's what it seems to me the Onondagas are suggesting to us, that they want to work together. This is an issue important to all of us, freedom and sovereignty and respect for our home.
It does seem like a more mature way to go about things. But I would like to make a thought to people, just to have a thought. The way I understand how things work, we have been living in the 400 or so years of the nicest weather that anybody can remember. All the geology says that for all times other than this time, the weather wasn't so nice. And there was sometimes even in that, around in some decades in the 17th century, when things were bad. But before that, there was long periods of very, very difficult times. And we're enjoying a period of good weather that will not last. It has never lasted in the whole history of the planet. It's not going to last now. Someday we're going to be wishing that we had put a little bit higher mind to what we were doing. And instead of fighting over the last gallon of oil, we're going to wish that we had tried to figure out what we were going to do when the weather got bad again. But the cooperative spirit of our species doesn't seem to be in gear. And we're not thinking about where things are going to go in the long future. In the end, the environment that we live in is the only environment that there's going to be for that future. And so it's always been in the Indian country that I always heard this, that we have to think about the future, generations and generations ahead. And I think that the Onondagas represent that thinking as much as any polity in North America represents it. And boy, we need to get that kind of thinking cranked up into other people's heads too, that in fact, the most important thing that can be done, it seems to me, is that we should be thinking about, okay, the day of oil will someday end. The day of good weather will someday end. Someday we're going to have to do things differently. And if we can anticipate what that would be like, this would be a very good time to get that in gear and not later when it's too late.
My question is actually on that note. I was just wondering what sort of ripples you've seen specifically about a basic call to consciousness, just the effects of that 30 years ago, like on today.
Basic call to consciousness was written in 1978, published, I should say, 77 written, but 78. The first thing that happened about it is that there was immediate reflections on it. People picked it up and read it, and they resonated to it. A few years later, about 81 or 82, I was in Akwesasne, and a fellow came to me from Brazil, and he told me this story. He said that they had gone from village to village in the Indian villages in the western Amazon, and they had translated Basic Call into Portuguese, and then in the villages they translated it from Portuguese into the Indian languages. And that the Indians had sent back a thing that they were in agreement with the message that was in Basic Call to Consciousness. That was probably the best compliment that I've ever had for any work I ever did or had anything to do with. And I think over the years that there's been a consistent pattern of rebirth of people who by rebirth of the message. As you know, it's still in print after all that time. And some people still get letters now and then from people who've been inspired to write me a letter. They mostly write letters saying that they liked it and it was a good thing for the most part. I was hoping that basic call to consciousness was going to be the first of a series of traditional Indian writings that might have illuminated what it's like, how the world looks from the traditional point of view. Certainly not as much of that has happened as I had hoped. Maybe it's going to happen now. I don't know. But I was hoping for more than I got. If anybody is interested, there's two things. One, there's a book out on the thing in the front, and it's called the Iroquois Creation Story. And what it is it's a version of the story of the woman who falls from the sky, but it also is an attempt to try to explain what that's all about, first of all. And the second was that I've been working on a book that speaks to the issue of Indian prophecies. What do the Indian prophecies have? And so I'm willing to put a very short explanation of where that goes. In some traditions, they say that the world is going to come to an end. But the Indian prophecies that I know and I'm willing to talk about don't say that. They say that the time that we're living in is going to come to an end, not the world. Humans will survive the time when things change. They'll survive it. They might not enjoy it, but they'll survive it. And there's a discussion in the prophecies about how people need to be in order to reconstitute themselves in such times. So instead of getting ready, on the one hand, the two conversations I hear in the West that are loud, one conversation says we should hurry up and do whatever we can do to stop the global warming and to reverse its effects. The other one says the world's going to come to a complete, absolute end and no one will survive and everyone will be dead. Well, okay, if we get B, problem solved. Don't have to worry about it. If we're looking for A, not going to happen. We're not going to be able to do it. And you can read the scientists' own things saying we're not going to be able to do it either. So there's a third option, right? And the third option is, what do we do if A and B don't happen? We have to ask ourselves, what do we need to live in the new and changed world? So this would be a very good time to adapt plants to cold, food plants, to adapt them to dry, to hot, to wet, to whatever. In the Andes, where they have the greatest number of cultivars ever developed in the planet, the Indians in the Andes have lived in environments which were not predictable. In a given spot, in one environmental cycle or agricultural cycle sometimes it's too cold, sometimes it's too hot, sometimes it's too wet, and sometimes it's too dry, all in the same place. So they've learned to plant different crops, some of which will survive cold, some will survive hot, but some will survive something, whatever it is that comes along. That's not a bad model. We need to think about that model. And then I think the other piece is we live in a civilization that depends a lot on our acquiescence to its models of transportation. Its models of transportation and its models of war are a death trap, that absolute death trap. Unless we find other ways to maintain transportation than this, and unless we can find ways to address the very horror that Eisenhower talked about in the military-industrial complex, where the people who have the power to decide to go to war make profits doing war, unless we have a way of reining that in and quit pretending that it doesn't exist and start thinking that we have some control over them when we don't, unless we do that, we're in a death trap. This is a very, very serious and critical time for us. And it's most critical because most of the people I talk to aren't even very aware that things are sort of bad, you know? One last thought, though, if I could just share this with people. I really appreciate it that people come out to affairs like this one. It is such a wonderful thing to see you all here tonight, because I know you could be someplace else doing something even more frivolous than this. So thank you so much for coming, and I enjoyed it.
That was Seneca Elder John Mohawk, writer, farmer, activist, and professor of American and Indigenous Studies at SUNY Buffalo, speaking in April in Syracuse as part of the series Onondaga Land Rights and Our Common Future. The next event in the series will be this Tuesday, June 13th at 7 p.m. at the Syracuse stage at Genesee and University in Syracuse. The topic is Onondaga Land Rights, All Central New Yorkers Can Benefit, with speakers B. Gonzalez, Wendy Gagne, Andy Major, and others. The series is free, and all are welcome. For more info, visit peacecouncil.net.
Loan me a minute, let me borrow your ear. I'll sing you a song about Leonard Peltier. He's gone so long in a federal jail, the innocent victim of a tangled tale. In South Dakota, where the fear was thrown, the presidents watched from a mountain of stone. They said all people were free to roam. There was a struggle for freedom in the Indian home. How many have gone before? And tell me how many more must be lost to the Indian wars? The company spoke to the high command. We need the deeds to the Indian land to dig for oil and uranium ore. Maybe have to start a little Indian war. The orders came from away on high, and if it was a job for the FBI, it won't be hard. All we'll have to do is just cause a little trouble and follow it through. In Oglala, where the spirit did dwell, if there was a time they remember well, women and children were gathered there when the wind blew a warning through the whispering air. And Leonard Peltier was a one of those who came to the call when the time arose. And dangerous strangers are prowling around, bringing trouble to the reservation grounds. And that was when the agents made their play in a gunshot battle on a deadly day. And three men died in Lakota land, two FBI and an Indian man. How many have gone before? Tell me how many more must be lost to the Indian wars? Joe Stunts was a man that died that day, but the eyes of the law didn't see it that way. All they cared about was their own kind. I'm gonna get somebody for a capital crime. The charge was set for homicide, but Lennon got away to the Canada side, where he lived for a while in the northern town, till they came up and got him and they brought him back down. Judge and the jury, they both agreed, two times murder in the first degree. They pounded the gavel and they rang on the bell, two times life in a federal cell. Citations came from Washington, congratulations on a job well done. Two agents gone is a mighty price, but if you want something bad, you gotta sacrifice. They took Leonard Peltier up away in chains, all of those years to suffer in pain. Oh, but all of those years makes a warrior strong, and the struggle of the people goes on. How many have gone before? Tell me how many more must be lost to the Indian war? Yeah. And so it's been since days of old, when Custer died for a mountain of gold. But times have changed and passed him by. He's been replaced with the FBI. Oh, it's all so easy to weep and moan for a warfare fought so far from home. You can preach a peace from a righteous stand while they struggle for peace on the Indian land. When Joe Stuntz was a lower down, the winds did blow with the mighty sound. The answer came in the driving rain, and this man will not have died in vain. For the hollow power of the lock and key ain't nothing to the power of the raging sea. The lightning strikes in the angry skies that puts the power into people's eyes. Oh, the weather is building to a mighty storm, and the words in the wind come to warn are once more spoken to your ear. Only this time the name is Leonard Peltier. How many have gone before? Tell me how many more must be lost to the Indian wars.
Jim Page. We have the physical ability to change the way we live in the world. So what is stopping the changes so needed by all and so desired by many? It must be what we think, feel, and believe. David Noble is a critical historian of technology, science, and education in the History Department at York University in Toronto. His recent book, Beyond the Promised Land, The Movement and the Myth, identifies the biblical idea of the Promised Land as a force that has and continues to shape the direction of our culture in ways that are now leading us into an apocalyptic conflict. I want to read to you now from that book, Beyond the Promised Land, The Movement and the Myth, by David Noble. This is the prologue. This book took shape around the turn of the millennium, a recent but now distant time. As the 20th Christian century drew to a close and the remnant of believers awaited ascent to another world, a different population took to the streets in defense of this world, shedding much of their Western ideological inheritance, their biblical birthright, as it were. Participants in the global justice movement embraced a new sense of themselves and the meaning and purpose of their lives. Unlike their forebears, they no longer suffused and sustained their struggles with ancient promises of redemption and transcendent guarantees of deliverance. Instead, they began to move into another plane of struggle beyond the Promised Land, having come to the understanding that beyond the Promised Land is the here and now. This book then took shape in another era, before 9/11, before the American Crusade in Iraq, before the eruption of the full fury of the people of the promise. As the warring heirs of Abraham fight it out across the globe, chosen people all, zealous Zionists, fanatical Christians, radical Islamists, the fresh start that was the global justice movement seems stillborn in retrospect. But if the project of corporate globalization proceeds apace, armed to the teeth, and with less overt opposition, it does so now also with less ideological legitimation than before the emergence of the global justice movement, hence the greater need for force. The mythological sources of this legitimation, the biblical narratives of perfection, fall, and redemption, have now exploded to the surface of Western consciousness in all their absurdity and horror, tearing through their more subtle, secularized manifestations in our ideas of history, technology, and the market, to lay bare the terrifying template of the Western imagination. It remains to be seen whether or not that eruption signals the demise of a deformed culture, or with a vengeance, its retrograde renewal. But its violence might yet awaken us to the urgency of moving beyond our formative myths, a shift barely begun by yesterday's global justice activists, whose message survives their movement. Is a post-biblical world possible before Armageddon? At the moment, that is the overriding question. Chapter 1. Introduction. Hope in the Here and Now. On September 10, 2003, 14,000 farmers and indigenous people marched towards the convention center at the start of the fifth ministerial meeting of the World Trade Organization, WTO, in Cancun, Mexico. Some 6 miles from the meeting center, they were brought to a halt by police barricades. Using a mock WTO coffin as a battering ram, they made a partial break in the barricade. At that moment, South Korean farmer Kyung Hae Lee, a former president of the Korean Advanced Farmers Federation, climbed atop of the rubble with his banner and stabbed himself in the heart. Earlier, the 56-year-old farmer had penned a message to the world explaining the reason for his suicide and exhorting his comrades to intensify the opposition to the WTO's free trade agenda. We Korean fellow farmers and myself realize that our destinies are out of our hands already, he wrote. He warned that human beings are in an endangered situation in the face of, quote, an undesirable globalization of inhumane, environment-distorting, farmer-killing, and undemocratic, and declared, it should be stopped immediately. Otherwise, the false logic of neoliberalism will perish the diversities of agriculture and disastrously to all human beings, close quote. 2 days later, Greenpeace activists from Mexico and Argentina bound themselves to the anchor chain of a ship carrying 40,000 tons of genetically engineered corn from the United States to the Mexican port of Veracruz. The U.S. dumping of GE corn in Mexico must stop immediately, Greenpeace campaigner Doreen Stabinski insisted. We are dealing with an emergency situation where one of the most important staple crops is at risk due to genetic contamination. The ship was temporarily forced back to sea, only to return later under Mexican Navy protection. A few days earlier in Cancun, Vandana Shiva had made public a citizens' GMO challenge to the WTO, a grassroots response to a complaint lodged with the World Trade Organization by the world's major growers of GE crops, the United States, Argentina, and Canada, against the European Union's restrictions on the importation of those crops. Given the abundance of alternatives, the risks that genetically modified crops pose to the environment and human health, the scientific uncertainty, and the lack of any socioeconomic advantages, we declare that the use of the WTO dispute settlement system for imposing GM food on the world is totally illegitimate, close quote. The bold actions and statements at the gates of the WTO put in relief what must be understood to be a radical break with the hegemonic ideological structure of Western society and the West-dominated world. Two of the central tenets of this structure were not only subjected to questions, but rejected outright. Faith in the ultimate beneficence of both the unfettered, self-regulating market and the untrammeled development of science and technology, so long enshrined in paeans to laissez-faire and policies of laissez-innover, freedom for unrestricted technological innovation, have been shaken to the core. In the past, any and all opponents to these heretofore self-evident truths had always been effectively derided, disarmed, and dismissed as enemies of prosperity and progress. But no longer. Here in Cancun, as anticipated 4 years earlier at the WTO meeting in Seattle, the tried-and-true shibboleths and strategies rang hollow and ran aground. On its final day, the WTO meeting collapsed in disarray, with delegates of the world's poor nations walking out in frustration and without any agreements on world trade. The decisive defiance of the evangelism of free trade and the enchantments of scientific and technological innovation that surfaced at Cancun signaled a far more profound rupture in the substrate of Western culture, an unseen fracture that, in fact, was what made the surface events possible. For this defiance reflected an unprecedented departure from the mythological foundation of the Western imagination, which has its roots in the Hebrew Bible. This fundamental shift in thought not only inspired the opposition, but also more significantly, gave it its resolve and confidence in the face of power and tradition. Of course, here as always, the pronouncements of the free traders were belied by the contradictions. Rich nations demanded the opening of other countries' markets for their goods in the name of trade liberalization and global prosperity, attacking their opponents as selfish and short-sighted, while at the same time protecting their own industries with tariffs, subsidies, and patents. Likewise, the promoters of genetic engineering heralded the elimination of world hunger and assailed the critics for being unscientific, indeed anti-science, while being unable themselves to marshal any sound scientific evidence for the safety or even the technological, economic, or environmental viability of their wondrous products. But their ideologies had heretofore been impervious to such contradictions, since the plausibility of their position rested not on facts but on faith, not on realities but on dreams. Thus, it was not evidence or arguments that rendered the new challenges so effective. More fundamentally, it was the erosion of the faith and the dreams, a fissure in the bedrock of belief in the myth of the promised land. Hence, the true significance of events like those at Cancun eclipses any concerns of the moment for all their drama and lies rather in a movement of mind beyond the promised land. Throughout Western history, the myth of the Promised Land has given resonance both to the legitimizing refrains of myriad regimes of domination and to the hymns of hope of those subject to them. But that those stories were fed from the same source served mostly to strengthen the hegemony of the powerful rather than subvert it, as the oppressed tended too readily to mistake their master's tales for their own, with the master's studied encouragement. More significantly, while the myth of the promised land could mean different things to different people, in all forms it had one basic structure, a structure that located the fulfillment of the promise in a place and time far removed from that in which it was offered, and that projected hope away from its source in the concrete contingencies and exigencies of life, indeed, in life itself, and into some abstract, predetermined destiny. The ideologies of technical progress and free market panaceas are only the latest secularized manifestations of this mythology. The rebellion against them, however, no longer derives from or defers to the same mythology. Instead, it draws its energy and insight from the opposite, an insistence upon the present and the particular, human volition, and an uncompromising affirmation of life. This explains the resolute refusal to surrender to predetermined and deferred destinies that are, quote, out of our hands. It is time to abandon the empty promises of religion, technology, and consumerism, an Australian activist declared several years ago. In Seattle, another anti-WTO activist reflected, "I saw that inevitabilities could be challenged." Beneath such words lies a new way of thinking that rejects the very notions of inevitability or of finding refuge in abstract promises. Over against what it sees as the moribund but still dangerous utopianism of the powerful, this way of thinking poses an anti-utopianism of hope in the here and now, of hope as trust in life itself, in the words of Christopher Lash. A disposition to see the promised land not as a distant objective, but as a present reality, the ground and basis of our being. The myth of the promised land is a tale told by strangers. It is a mythology of a people adrift, of a population without location, the rootless and restless, the displaced, the exiled. Cut off from any sustained terrestrial connections, they have sought their place in time, in an otherworldly arena of purpose, meaning, and direction, in reified ideas of God, history, and future universality and transcendence. At the heart of this mythology is the conviction that there is an overarching order to human affairs, independent of human will, that can be discovered through revelation or reason or some combination of both, and that people's fortunes ultimately depend upon whether or not they align themselves with this order. Today's break is a belated recognition and repudiation of this exilic remove from reality, out of which the Promised Land mythology rose in the first place. It aims not to erase the creative contributions to the human spirit generated by that myth of ceaseless motion and spiritual striving, but to correct for its undue overdevelopment in Western consciousness at the expense of more settled and sustainable existence. The new outlook, rooted once again in the particulars of place, recalls more ancient stores of wisdom from which the myth of the Promised Land took leave. And it does so in order to restore some balance to belief for the sake of human and planetary survival. And that was the introduction from Beyond the Promised Land, The Movement and the Myth by David Noble. Continuing to part one, the evolution of the myth. Recorded history dawned in the settled societies of ancient Mesopotamia, the world's earliest civilization. There, in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, 5,000 years ago, the invention of writing coincided with the development of pottery, leaving behind an enduring record of engraved clay tablets that chronicled the rise of cities and towns, kings and empires. The time and place also marked the advent of an agricultural economy, commerce, and systems of government and law. It saw the evolution of not only such technologies as sickles, plows, and hoes, irrigation works, wheeled transport, the potter's wheel, stone building, metallurgy, and sailing ships, but also of that epoch's most advanced culture of science, mathematics, literature, and the arts. The abundant cultural remains of this civilization reflect the hegemonic mythology of the age, grounded upon polytheistic and animistic religious practice, focused upon female fertility and rooted in a belief in the fundamental correspondence between human experience and the regular rhythms of nature and the cosmos. In the first half of the second millennium BC, this fecund society had come to be centered at Babylon, capital of the Babylonian kingdom, and the site of enormous intellectual endeavor and literary creativity. It was here that the first code of civil and criminal law was formulated under Hammurabi, and it was here also that the first masterpiece of human literature, the so-called Old Babylonian Epic of Gilgamesh, was written in the Akkadian language by an anonymous Babylonian poet. This remarkable saga recounts the exploits of the legendary Sumerian king Gilgamesh of Uruk, who had supposedly lived 1,000 years earlier. While there is no solid historical evidence that these events actually happened, or indeed that Gilgamesh ever lived, the Babylonian poem clearly draws upon earlier Sumerian poems and other still extant artifacts testifying that Gilgamesh was a subject of a much older oral and cultic tradition. Judging from the record of existing copies of the epic, moreover, we can see that interest in Gilgamesh endured for another 1,500 years after the Old Babylonian epic was written, especially in its latter form, edited in the 12th century BC. It's safe to say, therefore, that the Epic of Gilgamesh well reflects the spirit of this first permanently settled society. The later version was deciphered from parts of tablets first unearthed in the mid-19th century AD, after having lain in ruins for 2,500 years. Fragments of the earlier Old Babylonian masterpiece came to light over the next half century. The Epic of Gilgamesh imparts the wisdom of place, the worldly sense of a society in which people live in cities and cultivated the land. Rendered literally, it rejects as foolish and futile the quest for immortality and transcendence, and counsels acceptance and celebration of the human condition, its losses and limitations as well as its joys, as the only path to peace and happiness. The hero of the epic is the young and powerful King Gilgamesh, half divine in origin. His mother, Ninsun, was a goddess, but nevertheless mortal. Vain and tyrannical, the willful king lords over his people and tries their patience until they implore the gods to create a rival that might keep him in check. In response, the goddess Aruru fashions out of clay Enkidu, who, covered with hair, roams the wilds with the animals. To separate Enkidu from his herd, a trapper sends Shamhat, a harlot from Uruk, to civilize the wild man. She plies him with her charms, her bath and garments, her food and drink, and having succeeded in her assigned task, takes him to Uruk. There Enkidu encounters Gilgamesh in a contest of strength. Having surrendered his animal powers in his seduction by Shamhat, Enkidu loses the fight and submits to the king's supremacy. The two former rivals become like brothers. Together in search of fame and glory, Gilgamesh and Enkidu set out on heroic adventures. First, in defiance of warnings from the elders, and despite the initial hesitation of Enkidu, they succeed in slaying the fearsome Humbaba, guardian of the sacred cedar grove of the gods, which allows them to cut down the trees and use the timber for temple doors. Second, they slay the mighty bull of heaven, the constellation Taurus, sent to kill Gilgamesh by the vengeful Ishtar, goddess of love and war, after the king had derisively spurned her amorous advances. They also use the bull's enormous horns as vessels for holy oil. In retribution for defying the gods and despoiling and thereby desecrating nature and the cosmos, the gods declare that one of them must die and choose Enkidu. Despairing of his terminal illness, Enkidu at first curses Shamhat for making him weak and bringing this premature end upon him. But the sun god Shamast chides Enkidu for his ungratefulness, reminding him of Shamhat's gifts of the comforts of civilization and the companionship of Gilgamesh. In the end, Enkidu sings praises to her and, by implication, to the goodness of life. With the death of Enkidu, the core message of the epic commences. Gilgamesh, inconsolable in his grief for his lost friend, is overcome with a newfound fear of the fragile and finite limits of life and of his own mortality. With all his kingly energies, therefore, he resolves to find the immortal Ur-Nafisti and uncover for himself the secrets of eternal life. Ur-Nafisti was the sole survivor of the great flood, the deluge. Together with his wife, he had been granted immortality by the gods in their regret for having sent the flood to put an end to the noise of their human creatures. At the same time, the gods decided to try to reduce the noise level somewhat by making human procreation more problematic and by imposing some inescapable limit on the human lifespan through death for all but Ur-Nafishti and his wife. Gilgamesh takes flight from Uruk and sets out upon his fevered quest, wandering the wilds towards the ends of the earth. At length, after many trials, he arrives at the edge of the earth, where the waters of death divide the world of mortals from the eternal realm of Ur-Nafishti. Here Gilgamesh encounters the alewife Shiduri, a goddess of wisdom. He pours out his grief to her and explains his mission. Her response, in the old Babylonian version of the poem, is the heart of the epic. O Gilgamesh, where are you wandering? The life that you seek you will never find. When the gods created mankind, death they dispensed to mankind, life they kept for themselves. But you, Gilgamesh, let your belly be full. Enjoy yourself by day and by night. Make merry each day. Dance and play day and night. Let your clothes be clean. Let your head be washed. May you bathe in water. Gaze on the child who holds your hand. Let your wife enjoy your repeated embrace, for such is the destiny of mortal men. Impatient with Shiduri's wise counsel, Gilgamesh demands to be shown the way to Ur-Nafishti's ferry, and Shiduri obliges. But alas, in the later version of the epic, upon his encounter with mankind's immortal ancestor, he only hears the very same admonition about mankind's immutable mortality. The Anunnaki, the great gods, held assembly. Mamitam, maker of destiny, fixed fates with them. Both death and life they have established, but the day of death they do not disclose. Utanapishti chides Gilgamesh for behaving like a fool rather than a king. He challenges Gilgamesh to stay awake for 7 days. And after the king fails the test, Utanapishti mocks his quest to conquer death when he cannot even conquer sleep. Finally, as Gilgamesh is about to take his leave in grave disappointment, Utanapishti, at the suggestion of his wife, tells Gilgamesh where he can find the plant of rejuvenation deep in the sea. Gilgamesh searches for the plant and finds it after great effort. But while drinking from a stream on his return journey, he loses it to a snake. Having failed in his quest for transcendence, Gilgamesh returns to Uruk a wiser man. Reawakened to the wonders of a home, including his own rebuilt walls, Gilgamesh displays with renewed pride of place the splendor of his great city to the ferryman of Ur-Shanabi, in the same words used earlier in the prologue before his ill-fated adventure. A square mile is a city, a square mile date grove, a square mile is clay pit, half a square mile the temple of Ishtar, 3.5 square miles is Uruk's expanse. He came a far road, was weary, found peace, the epic intones. The wisdom of Gilgamesh is the wisdom of the ages. It is a wisdom that entails, through myth and ritual, an affirmation of life in the here and now and an acceptance of the limits of mortality, including death, in recognition of the fundamental and inescapable unity of humanity and nature. It is a wisdom ubiquitous in pre-modern, place-based mythologies, and it persists today in the enduring teachings of indigenous cultures. Yet, although the Epic of Gilgamesh was the product of one of the most advanced societies of its time, its wisdom has long since been identified as primitive and retrograde in the wake of the wholesale destruction of such civilizations and the marginalization of their survivors by the people of the promise. And I have been reading from Beyond the Promised Land, The Movement and the Myth, by David Noble, professor of history at the University of York in Toronto. Next week, we'll continue with the next installment, The Promise. Thanks for tuning in to Unwelcome Guests. You can download copies of this and previous episodes at our website, unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. My end, for my guns and my saddle will all